This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The path toward recognizing and understanding autism has been long, difficult, and emotional. It began nearly 80 years ago when a Mississippi toddler was institutionalized because of his odd behavior. His mother thought the boy was insane, but he would go on to become the very first person to be diagnosed with autism. Up until then, and for some time afterward, the condition was shrouded in shame, secrecy, and ignorance. It would take many of those 80 years for society to catch up, even for the medical community to move from citing the cause as uncaring mothers and attempting cures like feeding LSD to children with autism to the realization that autism is a group of complex disorders of brain development on which children fall on a kind of sliding scale. Well, now the story of that journey toward understanding has been chronicled in an extraordinary book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism, by John Donvan and Karen Zucker. John Donvan is an ABC News correspondent and host and moderator of the Intelligence Squared U.S. debates on public radio. He's also anchored ABC's Nightline. Karen Zucker is a journalist and television producer who has reported on stories domestically and internationally and was the producer or a producer for ABC's World News Tonight and Nightline, working with Peter Jennings, Charlie Gibson, and Diane Sawyer. Both have intimate connections with autism, Karen through her son Mickey and John through his wife's brother. John Donvan is with us from NPR's Washington studios, and Karen Zucker is with us by phone from her home in New Jersey. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Mike, very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Mike.
Let's start with your personal stories. Both of you have family connections to autism, but it was happenstance, or by happenstance, that you both came to work, I would imagine, at ABC News, and you've been collaborating on stories and feature segments on autism since 2000. How did that collaboration begin?
Well, John and I were both, John's a correspondent, I'm a producer, and we were doing breaking news and civil rights stories and, you know, anything that came up in the news. And so we had already been a team working together. And in 1996, my son was diagnosed with autism, and we decided we wanted to start to do stories to sort of get the word out. At the time, I didn't even know that John's wife had a brother with autism. Hmm. And then we sort of got rolling, and once we started, there was nothing on the networks at that point in time covering autism. It was, you know, people said autism, they thought you meant, you know, artistic, and we had a hard time actually getting anything done. But once we started, we were the first team to really create stories, everything from adults with autism to siblings with autism, bullying, and about half a dozen years through, we figured out we needed to do something that would be more enduring and decided to do a book.
So when there was when you first started trying to get these stories on the network, and you say you had a hard time doing that because no one knew much about it and it wasn't on television, it wasn't discussed a lot, that means you probably didn't know much about it either at first when your son was diagnosed. What was that moment like for you?
It was really scary, actually. And when I look back at it now, that it's now 20 years ago since he was diagnosed, and how little I knew and how much there was nothing out there. And they called it PDD-NOS. It wasn't even called autism at that time because the name keeps changing and the way we diagnose it keeps changing. So it was. I felt like I was fortunate that I was a journalist so that I could go out there and research it and figure out what it was, what could I do to help my son. And that's how, you know, I think John and I began the journey of covering it for television.
You wrote an award-winning article in 2010 that profiles the first ever diagnosed person with autism, a person I alluded to in the opening, Donald Triplett. And the first chapter of your book is about Donald, who was diagnosed in 1942. Obviously, autism has been around forever and well before his diagnosis. Why was he the first?
Well, I also want to point out that the last chapter of our book is about Donald,
right?
Because Donald is still alive today, and we were really fortunate to be able to get to know Donald, and he's become a friend of ours. And we know part of the story about how he came to be the first case just from the medical literature that exists from the 1940s. which tells us that as a little boy in a little town called Forest, Mississippi, he was born to two rather prominent, well-educated, and wealthy people. The Triplett family owned the bank in town, and his dad was a graduate of Yale Law School, and his mom was a college graduate who taught local public school. And Donald, after the age of around 1.5 or 2, it became clear to them that he was not like other children that they knew. He did not use language in the way that they were expecting. He did speak words, but he only repeated phrases that were said to him. It's called echolalia, from the word echo. Mm. He would repeat back things that were said to him. He also had seemed to be very disconnected from people, including his parents. He never cried for his mother. He never ran for the front door when his dad came home from work. He was very, very obsessed with things and objects. He liked to line them up. He needed things to always be the same. He would have a tantrum if the furniture was moved, or if he went on a walk with his mother down the street on a Monday. The next Monday, he needed to place his feet exactly where they had been before.
Wow.
But that said, all of this at the same time meant he had some terrific talents, most obviously for memory. In order to want things to be the same, he needed to remember how things used to be. So one time his dad knocked a bunch of beads off of a string, and Donald put them back in the order that they had been in before immediately. And one time when he was about 2 years old, his mother was playing some Christmas carols at the family piano. She only sang them once, but then he starts walking around the house singing them all. Again, amazing memory. He also had perfect pitch. So this boy, we know from the medical literature, is taken by his parents in 1938 to a clinic at Johns Hopkins University, and he's seen by a child psychiatrist named Leo Connor, who puzzles about it for 2 or 3 years. He sees Donald a number of times during those years. And then finally, in 1943, he publishes an article making clear that Donald's mother was wrong. He was not insane, nor was he intellectually disabled. Rather, he had, and as you said, Mike, it probably always existed, but it hadn't been recognized as such. He had something that Connor decided to use the word autism for. And he called Donald his case number one, literally Donald, but he didn't get the last name. It was just T blank. So we didn't know when we started out that he was still alive. We didn't even know that his name was Donald Triplett. That was Karen was the one who found, who did some great detective work.
How did you do that? Because it was just Donald T in this little town. Did you have the town, the name of the town?
Yeah, we knew that the town was in Forest, Mississippi.
Okay.
And we knew that in order to tell the story, we had to track him down. And so I was assigned the job of finding Donald. So it was 2007, and it was way before we were using our computers all the time and our phones. And so I did what any good journalist would do at the time, is I opened the phone book.
Yes, something and you can't do anymore.
Right. And I started to call all the T's in Forest, Mississippi, because we only knew that his last name began with a T. And I thought it could take months, but about a dozen phone calls in, I get an answering machine that picks up the phone. And I hear this voice that says, "Hello, happy spring, and have a wonderful fall, and a wonderful December. Happy 2007. And I know immediately, because I have a son with autism, just by the sounds of his voice and the way he's speaking, that we found him. That's it. That's Donald. I call up John. We got him. We found him. And now now the question is how do we get to meet him? Because we're not going to just go knock on his door and attack his privacy. And so we go through a series of steps, both John and I, calling reporters and family friends and trying to get permission to talk to Donald, and is it okay if we come by? And the really, really interesting thing about this story is that we learned something really amazing very early on. Everyone we spoke to was incredibly protective of Donald, and we were told, we will introduce you to Donald, but if you harm him in any way, we will track you down and we will get you. And it symbolized this community. Right away, we saw that there was this community that he grew up in, even in his 80s, that was still protecting him.
And the thing we were able to learn that wasn't in the medical literature is whatever happened to Donald, because the story more or less doesn't give much. The literature more or less cuts off around 1948 or so. Mm-hmm. There were some minor brief updates in 1955 about Donald's progress. But we got to really know the texture of his life. And it turns out that his mother really, really fought for him. She used her leverage to get him a place in public school, and the family made it clear that they wanted Donald accepted by the community. And I think probably because of their clout, the community accepted him, but they really accepted him. And the story went around. By the time Donald got to high school, and he did everything late. He was in high school 3 years later than everybody else, 3 years older. He went to college 3 years later. But in high school, the story went around that he was kind of a genius, like a whiz with math. And everybody we talked to in town, people who knew him back then, who are now in their 80s, would say, you know, Donald's a genius. He's a genius with math. And they also would say, you know, he would give you a number. And we said, what do you mean? He said, well, everybody he meets, he would give a number to. Because he had an obsession with numbers that's still true today. And he can do very quick calculations in his head even today. But people were very fond of the number, of knowing that Donald had assigned them a number. And they remembered them decades later, what the number was that Donald gave them back in 1951 or 52.
And he gave you a number, didn't he?
He gave us a number. Karen is 549, I'm 550, and we're flattered.
Is there a significance to the actual number that you get?
Oh, I think that, you know, I went first, so that must mean there's something to coming first. No, we don't know. We don't know what the significance is. But, in fact, I am sure there's a significance. My 22-year-old son does things with numbers also, where he categorizes people based on songs, based on numbers. And even though we don't know what Donald is actually doing with his numbers, we know that 60 years later they still have meaning to him.
Well, Donald's story is a great story, particularly for parents who have autistic children, because his has been a very successful, functioning life. He's a world traveler, as you mentioned. He's a high school and a college graduate. He worked in a bank. He's a golfer.
This is amazing. An interesting sense of humor. I mean, one of the other stories we heard when we went back about the 1950s, they said everybody would tell us this story about the bricks, and we would say, "What's that?" And they would say, "Don't you know, Donald, one time in 1951 or 52, counted all the bricks in the side of the high school building just by looking at it?" And indeed, we looked at the old photographs. That building's gone now, but there was this massive red brick building with no windows on the side of it. And the story is that Donald walked out of there one day, and there were some kids standing out front, and they said, "Hey, Donald, if you're so good with numbers, why don't you tell us how many bricks are in the side of the building there?" And Donald looked over his shoulder, glanced over his shoulder at the building, and looked back at these boys, and he tossed out the number. And their jaws just dropped. And people, those boys ran off and told everybody, and the story has persisted, you know, all these years later. But there's an interesting follow-up to it that Karen got out of him.
Well, it was legendary. So we had to ask him, you know, so how did you do it? How did you figure out how many numbers, how many bricks there were? And Donald looked at me and said, "I didn't." And I said, "You didn't?" He said, "No, I made it up."
Karen's.
And then really the thing that's most telling about it is when I asked him why, he said, "I wanted the boys to like me."
Mm. Wow.
Which tells you so much about autism, because you wouldn't think that, you know, people don't naturally think that. But in fact, people with autism really do have very intense feelings.
Karen Zucker is a journalist and television producer. John Donvan is an ABC News correspondent. Together they've collaborated on a book about autism called In a Different Key. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Wild Birds Unlimited. Charlotte, bringing people and nature together with bird feeding and nature products, located at Galleria off Independence and Huntersville, exit 25. Online at charlotte.wbu.com. And Providence Day School, offering a variety of half-day and full-day, one-week camps and programs June through August, where children and teens can play, learn, and create. Details at providenceday.org/summer programs. Well, Charlotte is is back in the boom business, with growth and development now focusing on older neighborhoods. So what happens to those neighborhoods and their longtime residents when redevelopment comes rolling through? Areas in the urban core like Villa Heights, Middleville, and Cherry are experiencing an influx of newcomers, and the style of housing going up is changing the character of those areas and driving prices up. We take a closer look at gentrification tomorrow morning at 9 on Charlotte Talks. Join us then.
On the next Day and Ream show, the suicide rate in the U.S. has risen sharply to the highest level in 30 years. It jumped 63% among middle-aged women. What's behind the alarming statistics, and what can be done to reduce the number of suicides in America?
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, John Donvan, ABC News correspondent, Karen Zucker, television producer and journalist. Together they have written In a Different Key, the story of autism, and a remarkable book. It's an enormous book, by the way, which tells a lot of different stories, because the story of autism is, as you point out, a lot of different stories. We spent a lot of time on Donald Triplett, who was the first person to be diagnosed officially as having autism. But you point out, Karen, that if you've met one person with autism, you have met one person. Does that mean that this condition presents itself in so many different ways that it's different in every single person who has it?
Exactly. And right now, in fact, you know, and the name of it and the diagnosis of it keeps changing. Hmm. And so right now it's called the autism spectrum. And it really truly is a spectrum that is massive in size, from somebody who is severely disabled, who might be banging their head against the wall and needing support their entire life, to someone who has a PhD, but because their deficits are so strong, so weak socially, they may be bagging groceries. And all of these people are called the same thing and everything in between.
Hmm. And when do you begin to know, or at what level, a person who has been diagnosed with autism is going to be able to function? At what stage of their life? And is it dependent on the kind of treatment that they get?
It's another thing where it really comes down to, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. They're really, it's so individual, so distinctive, that while from time to time researchers feel they've come up with some benchmarks and some indicators and some predictors, even with so for example, one of the predictions might be that if a child has language at a very young age, then that child can go very far. That may be true, but it's not going to be true for every child. And so, and then in terms of therapy, there have been so many ideas and ways to explain autism over the years, and in fact that's why the book got so interesting. And when I say interesting, I mean we're very fortunate as authors that it's really resonating also for readers outside the autism community, because it's so much about science and about how science can't solve everything when confronted by a mystery, how society can really get things wrong. And going back to the very first years after the concept of autism came into focus, and you mentioned this in the beginning, the thing that science, or that the authorities, that expertise told mothers was the cause of autism was the mothers themselves. Mm. There was a term coined called the refrigerator mother. And the idea came into focus that mothers caused autism by not loving their children enough. And that's why autism existed. So they did something in the first week or days of the child's life that frightened or traumatized the child through a kind of coldness on the mother's part. And so traumatized was the child that the child retreated into this world of his own. And it sounds so unbelievable now. But that was 100% the idea that ruled psychiatry into the early 1970s. If a mother went to the library to find out about autism and found a book, which was unlikely, but if she did, that book would tell her that it was her fault. Karen met some of these mothers who lived through this time period, and the pain is still there.
Hmm. Yeah, I spoke to one mother, and it was 3 hours into the conversation where she told me stories that she had never told anyone. And the really horrible part of this period is that you had these parents who were doing everything they could to help their their child who was struggling. And, you know, in the early days of diagnosis, really, children who were diagnosed were very, very severe. The spectrum wasn't as broad. And so these were children that needed so much help. And this one mother told me, Rita Tepper told me her story of how once her son was diagnosed, and she was a social worker, so she had studied psychology, so she knew that she knew the refrigerator mother theory. She knew that it was her fault that she hadn't loved her son enough. And so, you know, 3 years later, she's trying to figure out, you know, what is it that I did to make my child autistic? And she'd be talking to the psychiatrist, and she'd spent weeks there because that was the treatment. Because you didn't treat the child, you treated the mother, because that's how you could cure the autism. And one day she's sitting there and she thinks back, and when Stephen was first born, he was yellow because he was jaundiced, and he had this blonde hair that was standing up. And he was this scrawny little thing, and she had expected this round, cuddly, snuggly baby. And instead, she had this scrawny little baby, and she thought, oh, my God, that's it. I thought he looked like a chicken. And it was my thinking that he looked like a chicken that caused his autism. And, you know, 16
And that was
years
a breakthrough.
Later,
she saw that as a breakthrough at the moment because she wanted to figure out, what did I do wrong, so that she could try to reverse it.
You call that theory that the mother not loving their child enough was the culprit in all of this. You call that an ironclad theory. And this Dr. Leo Connor, who first diagnosed Donald Triplett and made him the first person to be diagnosed as autistic, in a paper called Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact. After that paper was written, you say, and published, he still believed that mothers caused, the coldness of the mother was the cause of the disease, and that became even more a popular theory. Was that because of him or in spite of him?
It's a little more complicated than that. Okay. Connor was, quite a serious thinker, but what he raised was the possibility that perhaps in some of the cases he observed that some of the parents seemed somewhat emotionally distant, and he thought that this could potentially be the genesis of the autism or exacerbate the autism. He also, though, at the same time was saying maybe the parents themselves have a little bit of autism, and was suggesting all along that it was also inherited. So he was struggling. We would say that he was struggling with the idea in the late 1940s and early 1950s. By the late 1950s, he had completely renounced that idea. Okay. The problem was that other people, including especially Dr. Bruno Bettelheim, who was a gigantic figure in the psychology and media landscape. He was like Dr. Phil and Dr. Oz rolled into one on television all the time and writing newspapers and magazine articles and books and giving talks. He completely believed that mothers had failed to love their children. And he said that once on the Dick Cavett show. He said, mothers just wish that the children had never been born, that it's a wish that the child were dead. He really was the guy who pushed this theory to a general public. You know, most of the general public didn't know anything about autism, but what they did know, they got from Bettelheim. And Bettelheim was the real believer in
Correct me if I'm wrong. Dr. Bettelheim, his doctorate was in art history. Is that correct?
It's an unbelievable story.
And he got away with it for decades.
Yeah.
Because he had a major, for lack of a better term, clinic in Chicago that was, the whole place was outfitted to counteract the coldness of the mother, which he believed to be the cause of all this. Great big stuffed animals, bright colors everywhere.
Right.
And we're going to talk about a fellow from UNC Chapel Hill in a little while, Dr. Eric Schoppler, who goes to Chicago to see what's going on. And he realizes right off the bat, this is just pure nonsense.
He did. He used an epithet we can't use on the radio when he saw it. And he came to that conclusion very quickly, and he came to that conclusion even though he was a graduate student. He didn't have his doctorate at that point. Mm-hmm. He was relatively inexperienced. But Bettelheim had everybody fooled. That's the tragedy of it, that Bettelheim really didn't know what he was talking about. He had everybody fooled. And the second part of the tragedy is that for all of those years that mothers were being blamed, mothers like Rita Tepper, the one that Karen was just speaking about, and the therapy was to give psychoanalysis to the mother. You know what wasn't happening? Any work on what we can do to help the kids. Because we already had the answer. The answer was it's the mothers. So there was no research done, barely by psychologists and not at all by biomedical science to understand the autistic brain at all for decades.
You also point out that in the early 20th century in America, the eugenics movement, of which we have a dark history here in North Carolina, was supported by many prominent people. They advocated purging, not helping mentally defective people. And that certainly affected the attitudes of society at large and the way we institutionalized these people. It must have also slowed down any attempt to really understand the root causes of these conditions, didn't it?
Well, that's the thing. In our book, there are so many different stories. There are 46 small stories that tell all of these histories. And one of the most tragic ones is the idea that people who were developmentally disabled and everyone was thrown into an institution, and all parents were told, if you have a child who's developmentally disabled, you need to put them in an institution and move on with your life. Mm-hmm. And that is what society did. That was the standard, because there was nothing else. And this is what the doctors told them to do. And so that's what everyone did. And it wasn't until parents fought back that institutions got closed down. And part of why children were in institutions was because there was nowhere for them to go, because the schools barred them. Children with autism were barred from schools. That was the law.
There was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, and I know that my parents felt this way, that when a doctor said something, the doctor's word was God's word. I mean, you didn't fight it, but something happened along the way, not just in autism, but in a lot of different areas of medicine, where people suddenly thought, well, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm an individual. I'm a human being, and I think I'm going to do this. You say in your book constantly that this is the story of parents. This is a story of parents taking control of their children's health and welfare and treatment. What caused that change?
Well, the 60s probably, and Vietnam and Watergate, feminism, all kinds of other social changes were going on at the same time that we think was part of what empowered parents. But the other part of it was that there's something about autism itself that's unlike other challenges that children might face in early childhood, like cerebral palsy or intellectual disability, where there's always been this sort of sense, which we think can be mistaken in some instances, that you can really maybe sort of figure out how to do something about autism, that there's going to be a key that unlocks it all. We just have to find the key. And we already talked about how blaming the mothers was one explanation, and the key was to get the mother to figure out what she had done wrong through psychoanalysis. But there have been many, many other suggestions through the years. Different sciences got involved. Some really crazy ideas got involved. But so that's the sort of downside of that. But the upside was that it always gave the parents the feeling that they needed to do something, they needed to organize, they needed to push back against authority. And Karen mentioned the fact that until the 1970s, which is really pretty recently, children with autism did not have a right to go to school. And we really mean no school. It's not that they were forced into special education. The special education programs said no to children with autism. And when the parents said, well, what are we supposed to do? They were told, that's up to you. You have to figure it out. And we tell the stories of parents, particularly focused on a couple of families out in California in the 1970s, who fought. Some were defeated by it, and some wouldn't give up and fought and fought and fought to get their kids into school. And they wheeled and they dealed and they dodged and they cajoled and they organized, and they finally got to courts, and they finally got to state legislatures. At the same time that the 60s was happening, they pushed back against authority, and that's how they really did change the world. That's why today so many of us have if you're part of the autism community, that's why your kid's in school. If you're not, that's why your kid is going to school with kids who are on the spectrum, because those parents fought to change the world and make a place in the world for their kids.
And part of that story has its roots in North Carolina, if I understand this correctly.
In a big way.
You spend a chapter in the book talking about Dr. Eric Schoppler, who came to the UNC Medical School in Chapel Hill and eventually set up a program to study children exhibiting signs of autism. What made his part of this story so significant?
Karen, do you want to take that? Or
no, you can take that. I mean, the headline of that is that Dr. Schoppler believed in parents. And that's the beginning of the story, which was very, very different than what went on everywhere else.
He saw them as co-therapists.
Right.
That was groundbreaking
because he started doing that in 1968, which was sort of the height of the time when everybody else was blaming mothers. He said not only are the mothers and the fathers not part of the problem, they're part of the solution. And he began to develop a program at Chapel Hill that was so successful in its initial efforts that word spread quickly. And in fact, there was a time in the 1970s, even into the 1980s, when people were moving to North Carolina if they had children with autism, because it was the best place in the nation to be. It was the only state that was offering really statewide help through the education system through a program called TEACH, which offered education through public schools, selected public schools that were spread all throughout the state.
And again, that's a story of parents getting involved,
yep,
because that program, or his initial program, was only funded for about 5 years. And a year before the program funding was about to run out, he told the parents in the program this was going to happen. And they began to work together, and they got the lieutenant governor involved. They got legislators involved.
And they had the famous breakfast scene, which is
famous
in the TEACH lore. The funding was about to run out, and Schoppler and his partner, Robert Reichler, who also worked in the program, actually themselves wrote the legislation, something they didn't know how to do, but they wrote the legislation, and it was sort of making its way very slowly through the legislature, but not fast enough. And so two of the mothers came up with this idea of, why don't we show the legislators what autism is and what our needs are? Why don't we do this? Let's feed them. And so one day in 1971, they borrowed a church basement across the street from the legislature, from the Capitol building, and they cooked breakfast in the basement, and they sent invitations to all of the lawmakers in the State House telling them that the place was going to be packed with media, which wasn't true because they didn't know any media. But then they contacted the media, and they said, we're going to be giving this breakfast, and it's going to be packed with legislators. So on the day, the place is packed with legislators and media. And as the lawmakers come in one at a time, they're placed at tables seated next to an autistic child, between two autistic child at these tables all throughout the basement, as the talks begin. And the lieutenant governor sits down next to a boy named George. And in the middle of the presentation, George suddenly picks up a spoonful of grits and shoves it at the lieutenant governor's mouth, which wasn't open at the time. So all these grits fly, and they spill down the lieutenant governor's tie. And the organizers see this, and they think, oh, no, we're done for. But to his credit, he took off his tie, rolled it up, put it in his pocket, listened, left quietly, and the next day went to the State House and became part of the team that pushed through the legislation that set up Division TEACH, which became world-changing.
You describe it as an oasis of transformed the state into an oasis of compassion, offering generous support services for families dealing with autism, in stark contrast to the rest of the United States. We'll come back and talk more about that with John Donvan and Karen Zucker in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexon Pruitt, lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court with regulators and at the deal table with offices in Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexon Pruitt. And the Mint Museum's Latin Music Concert Series, presenting an evening of Brazilian music and Latin rhythms from local musicians on Thursday, April 28th. Details available at mintmuseum.org. The suicide rate in this country has risen sharply to the highest level in nearly 30 years. It jumped 63% among middle-aged women. So what is behind the alarming statistics and what can be done to reduce the number of suicides in America? That's the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, right now is your chance. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Get to us through Facebook at WFAE or through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and we are coming right back.
May 3rd, 1971 was the first broadcast of All Things Considered. Since then, a lot has changed, but what hasn't is that we bring the news of the day to life through sound. Listen every afternoon.
Hear the latest news from NPR plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region on All Things Considered weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. ABC's John Donvan and Karen Zucker are our guests. They are co-authors of a remarkable book, The Story of Autism, called In a Different Key, and they join us both here for the hour. TEACH, this legislation that passed in 1971, would eventually influence other states and other nations in how they dealt with children and families with children who have autism. How long did that influence take to spread from North Carolina outward, and does it still have an effect today?
Oh, it definitely has an effect today. Karen and I, as part of our reporting, went to several countries, and it's very big in England, which we visited. It's also big in Israel, another country we visited. We did not go to Singapore, but it's very, very much practiced there. Places in Australia as well, and all over the U.S. Now, how long did it take? I would say it was pretty quick, because there was nothing else like it. We live in a world now where, especially since the 90s, there are many, many other programs have been developed, and so its prominence is not as extremely exclusive as it was back then. There are many, many more programs that school systems opt for. But TEACH is still big. TEACH is still big. And partly also, Chapel Hill trained a lot of the people who are now major figures in autism research came through Chapel Hill and came through that program, both in the U.S. And in the U.K. So TEACH's influence has been gigantic.
What were the big changes in North Carolina in 1971 when it became law and the programs began to roll out? What was different? What was suddenly being offered that made this an oasis?
There was a place to go. There was a program. Number one, it was paid for. That was the big, big thing. It was paid for by the state, and it was paid for through the education budget. And it was a place to go. It was a structured program. There were things given to parents to do with their kids. Again, huge change was making the parents into co-therapists. And so, again, we interviewed a mother who would go in every day with her child, watch how he was taught, then she would be taught how to teach him, and she could bring this home to family. And for families, for families to have something that they could do was just so huge, because, again, this is something we talk about in the book, is that autism is a family affair. It impacts entire families. My wife, whose brother has autism, has told me she grew up in a family that wasn't like other families because her brother's autism, which is very, very severe, changed the kinds of things that they could do, the places they could go, the places where they were even welcome to go back in the 1970s. And so it was very, very useful for families to have something. And there's a particularly difficult position to be in as a family member, and that's grandparents. Mm-hmm. Grandparents have it in a way easier and hard because, generally speaking, they're not living in the same household, but these are their grandkids, and they're seeing their own kids who they raised to be, you know, with the expectation that their own kids would grow up and have, you know, lives free of the challenges of raising a child with a disability. Well, now they see their own children struggling with raising a child with a disability. They want to understand, but they're outside the house, so they can't necessarily understand everything. It's been an interesting thing at our talks. A lot of grandparents have reached for our book and told us that it really gave them a sense that they never had before about what it is that their own kids and their grandkids are going through in that other house.
Is there a way to gauge or quantify, I'm not sure how to ask the question, what the impact was or has been since 1971 on the children who were helped by this? In other words, these kids, in the absence of a program like TEACH or and all of the other ancillary programs that have cropped up since then, would have been isolated, uneducated, etc. How many of them have gone on to be like Donald Triplett or to be like your son, Mickey, Karen?
Well, I mean, the thing is before then, everybody was institutionalized. So none of these kids had a chance at success. None of them had a chance to go to school. So the range is as large as the spectrum itself. So those that had potential could get to their potential. And there was no way to know before if they had potential because they didn't get any kind of treatment. And, you know, ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis, is another, right now is more of the gold standard that people start using on their children when they're very young. But none of these kinds of treatments were available. And so children who didn't speak never spoke. And children who didn't know how to care for themselves didn't have any kind of support to learn the steps, to learn how to literally everything from brushing their teeth to tying their shoe.
It's a really hard question to answer, Mike. So we don't have a clean answer to it because we don't have a control group in a sense.
Right.
But we do in a way, in that we know that the people who were put in institutions wilted in those institutions. We tell the story of a man with autism whose autism was not diagnosed until the early 1990s. But by that time, he was about 75 years old, and he had spent 60 years inside an institution. He had been put in an institution in 1919 when he was 5 years old. He didn't speak. The diagnosis his family was given was insanity, and his parents were told, put him in an institution. They used the phrase, forget about him. The mother said to this boy's name was Archie. She said to Archie's sister, who's Harriet, a little bit older, never tell the world that Archie exists. We're going to keep visiting him, but never tell the world that he exists. Mm-hmm. So little Harriet kept that promise for many, many decades, even while she was going to visit her brother. But finally, in the 1990s, while still visiting him and watching him really suffer, I mean, he spent his life in one room. Even as a little boy, he spent his room with adults, and then he grew up and became one of the adults, and then the adults who were there when he was there died, and he became an old man there in one room with all of these other people. She finally happened to be reading an article about autism, and she thought, my gosh, that sounds like my brother. And she brought in an expert who diagnosed him in 1990, and he finally got out. Well, when he came out, he still couldn't speak. He didn't smile. He didn't seem to have any relation to people. But in the last 8 or 9 years of his life, given the chance to live in a decent home and to have a relationship with his sister, he began to smile. Mm. He began to let him touch her. They touched each other's faces. He began to play with toys. As an old man, he began to play with toys and to ride a tricycle. And he even learned to jump up and down on his bed. So much so that there were cracks in the ceiling above his bed, and the staff at this little home where he was living with just a few other people in the house, as opposed to 30 men in one room, were always trying to get him to stop jumping up and down because they were afraid he was going to hurt himself.
Yeah.
But as an old man, he finally got a life, and he did grow in those last 8 or 9 years when given the chance. So that's a little bit of a control group.
His is not the only story of an older person who has had this condition for their entire lives. Donald is another one. Donald Triplett, who's 82 now, or at least was 82 when you met him. And that, to me, is one story or several stories you could use to debunk what has been going around in the popular conscience for so long about vaccines. Because these people came down with these conditions long before vaccines were ever used. And you trace this back to 15th century Russia, where autistic people were referred to as holy fools touched by God. How did the misbegotten notion of vaccines being a cause of this ever become part of the conversation?
It was because it coincided with the perception that there was suddenly a lot more autism than there used to be. Starting in the 1990s, reports began to come out of California that the rate of autism being recorded, especially by the school system, was skyrocketing. And so people asked, and it was not an unreasonable question to ask, what's different? What's changed in our lifetime, and or even since the 90s, that would explain this other change. And people struck on the idea that vaccines were this thing being put into kids' bodies at a much higher rate, which is true. It is true that the load of vaccines the kids were given in the early part of their lives increased significantly between the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. We think it was worth asking the question. The thing is, the question was asked, and it was studied, and it was answered. It's definitive that the epidemiological studies, where they look at large numbers of the population, show that there is not an increase in autism that correlates with the increase in the dosage in vaccines.
Was there, in fact, an increase in the number of people being diagnosed, or did we simply come to understand more clearly what this condition was?
It's a combination of factors mm-hmm. because we keep changing the definition of autism. And so as we change the definition, we broaden what autism is. And by doing that, you include more people. So that's one reason that we're counting more people than ever before. Now, we can't say definitively if there are, in fact, more people or not more people because we just don't know. But we do know that there are things that have changed over time that would allow us to count more people than ever before.
There's one story
mm-hmm. that John and I like to point out because it's really the essence of what we're trying to get across in our book and we want people to walk away with, which is what we as a society can do to change things. And we have this story we call the bus story.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It comes near the end of our book, and we put it there on purpose. It's a scene that happened in 2006, really did happen on a bus in a town called Caldwell, New Jersey, city bus, and a young man with autism is riding on this bus by himself near the front. And he's not a person with autism who can speak or who has a great deal of independence. In fact, he was being given lessons in how to ride the bus by a teacher who was sitting several rows in the back watching things. And suddenly, the two passengers get on the bus at a stop, and they sit down behind the young man. And as the bus moves off, they notice that he's making some noises, and he's squealing sort of, and he's rocking back and forth in his seat, and he's flipping his fingers in front of his eyes, which is a autistic behavior that some people do called stimming, self-stimulation. And he's flipping his fingers. And this really starts to bother them, and they began to harass him. And they lean into him, and they say, "Hey, man, you know, what's wrong with you? What's your problem?"
And then
stop
all of a sudden, this other passenger jumps up and says to him, "Hey, what's your problem? He's got autism. Why don't you back off?" And at that moment, the whole bus rose behind this young man and the passenger who stood up for him. And that the bus at that moment became a community, a protective place for this person who was different. And we see that as could be the story of autism all over the world, which is we need to have the backs of people who are different. We need to stand up for them. We need to be the people on the bus. And we can do that. And we can do that without – it doesn't cost us anything. Compassion is for free.
Wow. I don't want to leave this conversation without talking about something we haven't discussed yet. Children get all the attention. Children with autism get all the attention, or at least in my experience, that's what we've always talked about on this program. What about adults? You have a 21-year-old son, Karen, who is now an adult. He's able to fly across the country on an airplane by himself. What is life like for the majority of adult people with autism in America?
Well, that's the other piece of our book, which is we say, you know, we've come so far in what we've been able to do for people with autism, but they're mostly children. And it's a job half done because adults have very little out there. They say, there's a saying, when your child turns 21, they fall off a cliff because they have all these services as a child, and we teach them all these skills, and then they become adults and there's nothing for them, or almost nothing. There are pockets of excellence, but in general, we don't know people with autism, and we have not made a plan for them. And there are hundreds of thousands of children that are growing up to be adults, and we haven't figured out how to find a place in the world for them. So that's really the next frontier that's out there, and that's scary because there's so little out there.
I was going to ask, and I guess I will before we end the conversation, about the prospects for a cure, but I also want to ask about this movement, the neurodiversity movement, that believes that those with autism should not be cured because they are just fine the way they are, and that curing them would fundamentally change who they are. How large is that movement, and how widespread is that opinion?
It's hard to say how large and widespread. It's very vocal. Because it's primarily populated by people who are capable of independence and of great language, great use of the internet. They're very passionate. Their inclusion in the conversation is a great thing. However, it points to a fault line that's developed, and that a lot of parents would like nothing more than to see their child cured of autism, or at least to have their autistic behaviors treated in a way that they don't become an obstacle to their independence and happiness. On the other side, though, the neurodiversity movement, which is a very broad term, and it does mean different things to different people. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say Karen and I subscribe to the neurodiversity movement if it's described as let's accept people who are different. That's what we were just talking about on the bus. Let's accept and have the backs of people who are different. But there are some people who take the argument to the point that you just laid out to say, you know, that I am autistic. That's who I am. I'm proud of it. It works for me. I want your support. I don't want you to try to change me. And so that's a tense conversation. And it's probably the most important turn in the conversation to happen in the last few years.
We have about 30 seconds left. Given the nature of autism, are we likely to discover the causes? Are we likely to find a cure?
I would say not in our lifetime. And I think what we would say is let's figure out what to do for the people who have autism, who are here, how to support them, how we can all be the good passengers on the bus who stood up and have those people's back. Let's make that our priority.
ABC News correspondent John Donvan and Karen Zucker, an ABC News producer, have written this book about autism together. It's called In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. Very long, very comprehensive, very interesting. Thank you both for the hour.
Thanks, Mike.